OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. This show is for Parshat Vayigash. It is a post-Chanukah show, and that will be reflected in some post-Chanukah thoughts, including a piece of a shiur I gave to the Torah Tidbits folders yesterday, which was Zot Chanukah, the last day of Chanukah. Today being the date of recording and first broadcast, Thursday, Yom Chamishi of Shabbat Parshat Vayechi. It is the fourth of the month of Tevet, the first Yortzeit of a very good friend, Hilary Sher, Oleha HaShalom, and the learning of this show is dedicated in her memory. Later I'll be going to an Azkara at the cemetery and in her home, and her neshama should have an aliyah. And just for the record, it is December 13th, 07, in the general secular calendar. Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir hama'alot mima'amakim kraticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli, tihyena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Ima vonot tishmarya Adonai miya'amod. Ki imacha hasalicha lema'an tivarei. Ki vi ti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya, ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yirachem aleihem, v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha, u'meyafela la'ora, u'mishibud l'gu'ula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, v'nomar, amen. As I mentioned earlier, yesterday, on the last day of Chanukah, I spoke to the Torah Tibbetz folders. I'll be speaking to them again shortly, and maybe I'll share some of that with you as well. And I spoke about the significance of the number 8 as far as Chanukah is concerned. As you will hear, here now is part of that shiur. Famous question about why we have 8 days of Chanukah in the first place. The story that we all start with from kindergarten is Labriut, after the victory of the Chashmonaim, they came into the Beit HaMikdash, they had to clean it up, they looked for fresh oil, they only found one day's supply, and it miraculously lasted 8 days, and that's why we have 8-day holiday. So first of all, there's a famous old question as to, wait a minute, let's do the arithmetic. A one-day supply of oil lasts for 1 day. If it lasts for 7 more days, then there are 7 days of miracle. And therefore, if the holiday was declared because of the miracle of the oil, then it should be 7 days of miracle. The question has captured people throughout generation after generation, century after century, to the point where books have been published with that question and the answers, and the questions on the answers and new answers. And you almost see that the people who have been answering these questions have fun with it. It's, I'll show you where the 27 answers that I've read till now, none of them are really good, and I think I have the correct answer. And then comes the next guy and says, no, that's not good because of this, etc., etc. So first let me say, I don't believe that we have an 8-day holiday because the oil lasted for 8 days. I believe rather that the oil lasting for 8 days became a symbol of the 8-day holiday, which Chazal declared. And the reason that I'm saying that I don't believe it's so simple is we say in Ma'oz Tzur that B'nei Vina, men of deep understanding, Yemei Shmona, 8 days, Kavu Shir Urananim, they established for the singing of songs and praise and the saying of Hallel. You don't need B'nei Vina, men of deep understanding, in order to say, oh, the oil lasted 8 days, so we'll have an 8-day holiday. There is no rule in holiday making. Not that we have too much experience in that, because there are chagim from the Torah, and chagim come in either 1 day or 7 days. Even Sukkot is a problem. Before we get to Sukkot, let's just review what we're talking about. Pesach is a 7-day holiday. That's a full week. That's one way that the Torah went in celebrating something. Pesach Mitzrayim, by the way, the original first Pesach was 1 day. And then Pesach Ledorot, for the generations, was a 7-day holiday. Shavuot is a single day. Rosh Hashanah is a single day from the Torah. We celebrate two for technical reasons. Yom Kippur is a single day. Sukkot is 7 days. Basukot tishvu shivat yamim, you dwell in the sukkah 7 days. Ulekachtem lachem vayom harishon, you take the arba minim on the first day. Usmachtem lifnei Hashem Elokeichem shivat yamim. Added to that is a 1-day holiday called Shmini Atzeret. So here's the first wrinkle in what I'm saying. It's true that when we look at Sukkot, we see 8 days, and in Chutz Laaretz 9, but again, that's technical reason. But it's really not. It's really an 8-day holiday. We say a 7-day holiday. We say Chag Sukkot Hazeh for 7 days. And the 8th day is not really the 8th day. It's really a Chag Bifnei Atzmo. We say a separate Shechianu for it. We rename it Yom HaShmini Chag HaAtzeret Hazeh. Of course, you can't avoid the fact that it's sort of attached and it becomes 8, but I would rather call it 7 plus 1. If we call it 7 plus 1 for Sukkot, then we're set. Holidays are 7 or 1. And in one case, a 1 and a 7 combined to a 7 plus 1. Comes and Purim, which predates Chanukah, is a single day. All right, it's 1 day in the rest of the world, and it's a different day in Yerushalayim, but in essence, it's a 1 day holiday that we say Al HaNisim. So that fits. Came Chanukah, and they didn't make it a 1 day holiday, which they could have. Doesn't matter what happened. They could say, because there was a victory of the Chashmonaim over the Yevanim, and we purified the Beit HaMikdash, and we started functioning in the Beit HaMikdash, we hereby declare a 1 day of holiday on the 25th of Kislev to be called Chanukah. Like Purim. And it could have been like that. Or they could have gone the whole way and said a 7-day festival. They chose 8, I believe, because 8 represents what we were fighting for against the Yevanim. The Yevanim, Greek philosophy, Hellenism, was nature. Body beautiful, athletics and art and statues, but the body, nature, was the thing. To the point where one of the mitzvot which they picked on most was Brit Milah, because that they considered to be a mutilation of the body. How can you take the body that the gods, in their terminology, created and gave you and mutilate it with this circumcision? Where the Jewish answer to that is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, capital G, singular, Yachid Be'olamo, in this world and in any world, God created the human being purposely to challenge him to complete the act of creation. We have a physical token of that called Brit Milah. we have a spiritual challenge that lasts a lifetime. When we say at a brit, the bracha al hamila, the moel says it, and it's done. But lahachniso bevrito shel Avraham Avinu, to enter the child into the covenant of Abraham, is a lifelong commitment. So that's our answer. And we go, let's say, according to the Maharal Miprag, who says 7 is the natural number in the world, and 8 represents me'al lateva, above nature, which is what Judaism is. Judaism says there's nature in this world, and the rest of the world, including the Greeks, including everybody else in the world, need concern themselves with nature. And that's symbolized by Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. 7 categories of mitzvah, 7 laws of Noahides, and that's natural. In fact, if you go through the list, it's all natural. The first mitzvah that was unnatural was Brit Milah. And it's very significant, not only that it's on the eighth day, but it's the eighth mitzvah. It's the eighth mitzvah that says to Avraham Avinu, you and your descendants will take nature and rise above it. Above the mazal, above nature, above the natural, and that's represented by Brit Milah, and that's what the Greeks targeted. And when the Hashmonaim were victorious against the Greeks with the help of God, they symbolized, and Sanhedrin confirmed it by establishing not a one-day holiday, not a seven-day holiday, but an eight-day holiday. To stick it, I shouldn't put it like that, to stick it in the face of those who tried to take it away from us, this is what Judaism says. There's a physical world and there's a spiritual world, and the spiritual world rises above nature. And that's represented by eight. But now let's get back, and that's why today, the eighth day of Hanukkah, is called Zot Hanukkah. You want to know what Hanukkah is? This is Hanukkah. 8 days. Now, 8 days and eighth day, let me digress for a moment, because this is an interesting thing which carries through with the eighth and the eight. What do you call the third meal on Shabbat? Sudash Lishit is the modern Hebrew term. What's it really called? How do we say it in Mama Lashon? Shalosh Seudot, which got slurred and Yiddishized into Shalosh Shudas. But Shalosh Shudas means not the third meal, which it is. It means 3 meals. The mitzvah on Shabbat is 3 meals because that goes beyond the physical requirement of every day, which was 2 meals a day. That was the way of the world. And Shabbat is honored by the third meal, but you can't have a third meal unless you've had a first and a second, which means the third meal represents the 3 meals of Shabbat, which is the mitzvah. Similarly, you could play the game here. The by the way, what do you call 8 versus 8th? What are the words in English for those? Good. Ordinal numbers. Very good. 8 is an ordinal number. No, it's a cardinal number, right?
Order.
Ordinal?
8th. Order. The one in order is 8.
Okay, so that's the ordinal number. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is, 8 days of Hanukkah, the 8th day of Hanukkah. But look what we've been doing all week long. We haven't been lighting, as I mentioned in the past, we haven't been lighting 1 candle the first night. We light 1 out of 8. How do I know? Look at my Hanukkiah. There are 7 empty slots waiting for the second night. Second? What do you mean second? Second of 8. Just like we say the days of the week. Today is Yom Rivi'i. But that's a short way of saying Yom Rivi'i of Shabbat. When we say it in the davening, we say Hayom Yom Rivi'i b'Shabbat. Shebo hayu halavim omrim b'Beit HaMikdash. So, in each time that you count, yes, you have a first, a second, and a third, but you always have a goal. The goal is not just to reach the eighth day. The goal is to have 8 days. And I believe there's a qualitative difference between those two. Be that as it may, the answers in the books. You can't take it away from it. There's a whole book that I have called Ner Lemeah, Candle for 100, because it has 100 questions of that same question and attempted answers. And I'm telling you, the fun part is not the answers. The fun part is when somebody, before he gives his answer, says, no, that other one doesn't work. And I'll give you some of them now. They say that it was a miracle that they even found the one-day supply. And by the way, there's something to that, because we have to realize that miracles come in a couple of different flavors. There are some miracles that are dazzling. Wow, I can't believe it. Or a sea splitting and a nation drowning in the sea trying to pursue the Jews who ran through it on dry land. That's a dazzling miracle. The sun and the moon stopping at Yehoshua's request or demand. That's a dazzling, supernatural, classy kind of show-offy kind of miracle. But then there are the more subtle miracles. A miracle of timing, for example, when something happened exactly when it needed to happen. And those are miracles too. So if you want to say that there's a miracle that in all of the destruction and desecration of the Mikdash, it was a miracle they found one unbroken seal flask to last even a day, that was a miracle too. The problem with that is you don't make holidays and mitzvot on those kind of miracles. There are plenty of things which we say, oh boy, you know, I was having such a hard time getting across the street. The traffic was coming and it was heavy and it was fast and it's a miracle that I got across. True. We use that word, but it doesn't mean we're going to go out and celebrate that miracle the way you celebrate other kind of miracles. Others then say that had the first day supply of oil run out in the first day, there would not have been any oil left, and therefore there would not have been any miracle. And they call on the Navi, which was actually the Haftorah of Parshat Chayei Sarah, the story of the Shunammite woman, where she is destitute, her husband died, her children are going to be taken to pay off debts into indentured servitude, and she goes to Elisha the prophet to plead for her case. And he says to her, what do you got in the house? And she says, I have a little olive oil. And he says, take every vessel that you have, every empty pot and pan and dish and glass and styrofoam cup and, aluminum tin and all of those kind of things. Borrow from your neighbors and get as many vessels as you can. Smear a little bit of oil in each vessel. And she does. And he says, got any more vessels? And she says, nope, that's the last of them. House was loaded with vessels. And a miracle occurred and all of them filled with oil. And the commentaries say, why'd she have to go through smearing a little bit of oil into each one of these vessels if God can, how do you say the present tense of wrought a miracle? You know the present tense
work.
Of wrought?
Work.
Work. Very good. Two work. Points again. To work. That's the present tense of wrought. Wrought is the past tense of work. So it was work, but it's different connotation. Anyway, God can certainly make oil appear in an empty vessel, just like he could make a little smear of oil fill the vessel. But he doesn't do that. He usually doesn't do that. What he does, something from nothing, that was creation of the world. After that, in fact, during creation of the world, after something from nothing, it became always something from something. That's the way God works in this world, and that's how they explain that the Shunammite woman had to put oil into each one of the vessels before the miracle would occur that it would fill. And that's how they explain how the one day of supply of oil could not have totally finished, because then there wouldn't have been any left for the second night and there wouldn't have been a miracle. The miracle was that the one day of supply of oil didn't even get used up in a day. That's a miracle, and that there was oil left over for the second day, third day, etc., to work. Now, the next guy comes and shoots that down. He says, all right, you want to say there was a miracle on the first day that the oil didn't use up? Fine, let's count again. First day miracle, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. What happened on the eighth day? There was a whole supply of oil. So it burned and it finished because they had new oil there. So there wouldn't be a miracle on the eighth day or whatever. Then they try all kind of other things. They say that they filled the cups of the menorah on the first day and the pach remained full. So that would again be a miracle on the first day. But then it doesn't answer the last day again. Others say that they filled the oil and it just kept on burning and burning and never went out. So they didn't have to do it the next night. Whatever. Then they say, which is an answer that appeals to me, it's a little variation, that realizing that they had only a one-day supply that they would need to last for 8 days because of the Tumah Tahara rules and the method of preparation of new oil, they only put one-eighth of the supply in the oil cups of the menorah on each of the days. In other words, here they had a one-day supply. They knew that it would take them 8 days till they got new oil and be able to do it regular. So they said, look, rather than the menorah going empty the rest of this week, let's put in only for a couple of hours. So they put in a small amount the first night, and it miraculously lasted the whole night. Then the second night they put in a one-eighth amount, and it miraculously lasted all night, etc., which means it's a miracle each day. So others want to shoot that down and say they had no right to do that. When you don't have enough, all you are humanly expected to do is use what you have. So you put in the full amount the first night. Worst comes to worst, you won't have any left. And worst comes to worst, the menorah will go unlit for another week till you have new oil. No big deal. It wouldn't be their fault. They looked and they wanted to light the menorah. Let's say they didn't find anything. Had they not found anything, they would have said, okay, well, it'll take us a week till we get new oil. So they clean up everything. They start other functions in the Beit HaMikdash if possible. And when it comes to the menorah, they said, we have no choice. We have to wait. No big deal. Or they found a one-day supply. So they found a one-day supply and they said, okay, we only have one for 1 day. Load it up. Light it. It's a joyous occasion. When this runs out, we'll have to wait a week in order to get new oil. Again, no big deal. We're not talking about the life-threatening situation of fighting against the Yevanim. We're talking about not a serious issue because the requirement of lighting the menorah each day implies that you have what to use to light the menorah. If you don't, you don't. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Vayigash. Before we continue with the Hanukkah retrospect, let's call it, I would like to play for you a song which I am pleased to say I recently transferred from an old cassette. It's a early Pirchei album, maybe the first, when they had records which kids today look at and we have to tell them this is a big black CD from the old days. And cassette, which is what I had, and I have decided to start transferring some of my many, many, many cassettes onto the computer, or at least onto a Wave and MP3 recorder that I have, and be able to listen to them and use them, etc., etc. This is a song called Rachem. It's from the Shabbat Zmira of Tzur Mishalo. It is now one of many Rachims that are out there, but I think it still remains my all-time favorite, and I now have the opportunity to share it with you because of the wonders of wave recording, etc., etc. Therefore, please enjoy Rachim.
Thank you.
Pirchei with Rachem from Tzur Mishalo, this stanza is in essence a prayer echoing that which we say in Birkat HaMazon of the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, the coming of Mashiach. It is certainly an appropriate Shabbat song. It is an appropriate post-Chanukah song because Chanukah commemorates the rededication of the second Beit HaMikdash. But 200 or so years after the Chanukah miracles, the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed and B'nai Israel, the people of Israel, were exiled, an exile which we still are suffering now, even though we have experienced a partial return to Zion. And we all look forward to the Geula Shlema, the complete Geula, and the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. It is also appropriate for the pre-Asara B'Tevet. Next week we have a fast day, which commemorates the beginning of the siege around Jerusalem in the time of the first temple by the Babylonians. And we are haunted every year that we come to this date and the other dates of the fasts related to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, because the Beit HaMikdash has not yet been rebuilt. And it has not yet been rebuilt because we have not pulled our act together. I don't blame God for this, and whatever helping hand He must give us, He will. But we have an opportunity, as every generation has had, to correct the ills that brought about the destruction of the first and second temples, and see the building of the third temple, however that will happen. Therefore, a song asking for God's mercy and for His return of Jerusalem and to Jerusalem and to the Beit HaMikdash is an appropriate post-Chanukah, pre-Asara B'Tevet and Shabbat mood setter, because it comes from one of the popular, well-known Friday night Zmirot. That, and the fact that I was able to salvage it from a cassette and put it into the more modern Wave and MP3 format, is why you were able to hear it, and I hope you enjoyed it. Let's continue the thread that we left off a short while ago. If somebody on Friday night had no candles and no electricity and no light in his home, he'd be exempt from the requirement of lighting Shabbos candles. It wouldn't be a sin not to light. A person is doing the wrong thing if they have candles and they don't light Shabbos candles. But if you don't have Shabbos candles and you can't get any and it's not your fault, there's no sin to it. So there wouldn't have been a big deal. Another answer tries to suggest that they took extra thin wicks, not the regular thickness which would burn up this oil in the course of the night, but thinner wicks, so that at least they would have a feeble light each night until they had new oil, and a miracle happened that it burned as if it were a full brightness thing. It would be like putting in a 10-watt bulb, and miraculously it burns like a 150-watt bulb. There are others that shoot down that answer too. I won't go into all 100 of them, obviously, since I don't know them all by heart, and I only have, in this Sefer, 63 of them. But I have the Sefer with 100 at home. But I want to just share one or two more. My favorite, probably, is that it's a miracle that oil burns in the first place. In other words, nature is a miracle also. A one-day supply. Here, take a lemon. Squeeze a lemon. Take a wick. Put it into that and light the wick. What happens? It goes out. Take olives and press the oil out of them and put a wick in it and burn, and you have a beautiful flame. That's something to celebrate also. That's something to admire and to appreciate God for, which we take for granted. So it almost works like this, and it's really a sort of a Hasidish kind of twist, as much as I hate to admit it. It's the miracle of oil lasting as long as it did. That's what we're making the fuss about. But along the way is a recognition that oil is a wonderful thing in the first place. That olives, which you can pickle and enjoy their taste, also gives you an oil that is so beneficial. The idea that nature is also miraculous, but we never appreciate it, or we always take it for granted until something spectacular of an open miracle comes along, allows us to backtrack and appreciate the mundane in it also. There's a story in the Gemara about a daughter of some rabbi, I don't remember his name, who said they were very poor, and she said, we don't have any oil to light even Shabbat candles this week. And she was very sad about it. He said, what do we have? She says, we have vinegar. He says, use vinegar. And she used vinegar, and it lit like oil. So that's a statement in the Gemara about a miracle that you're not supposed to rely on. I question whether she was allowed to make a bracha when she lit that. But if a miracle happens, it happens. By the way, there's a very interesting discussion in some of the sources. And again, I say these are the fun discussions. The serious discussions are, where do you put the Chanukiah, and what do you do on Motzoi Shabbat, Havdalah first, or candles first, or how high this? You know, those are the practical questions. The fun questions, meaning the ones you could sit back and relax while you're eating latkes or sufganiyot or something like that, are things like these kind of questions, where it doesn't really make a difference. But here's a question. If oil miraculously appears, the question is, what is it? Is it oil that was squeezed from olives? No. So how can you use it in the menorah and the Beit HaMikdash if the oil that the Chashmonaim had for the lighting of the menorah was miraculous? Then maybe it doesn't qualify. Because the Torah says you've got to use oil from olives, not oil from miracles. It's a discussion. But to me, the key is that Brit Milah connection. Let's leave Hanukkah now and take a quick look at Vayigash, this week's Torah reading. We have here, I can't really call it the culmination of the story, but certainly the cliffhanger of last week's Sedra, when the brothers were all arrested by this enigmatic leader in Egypt, and the culprit who was framed and accused of having stolen the silver goblet of Yosef turns out to be Binyamin. And the brothers had offered they would all become slaves to Paro, and that the culprit would be put to death. And Yosef magnanimously offers that they all could go free, except the culprit will become a slave. Here was that poignant situation, deja vu again, as they say, where the brothers were confronted with returning in peace to their father Jacob without another son of Rachel. Remember that there was jealousy against Yosef, and part of that jealousy, at least, was due to the fact that Yosef's mother Rachel was the favored wife over their mother. I'm talking about Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zevulun's mother, Leah. And here's Binyamin, little boy Binyamin, the only one of the sons of Yaakov to have been born in the land of Israel, irrelevant for the point now. But he is facing a fate very similar to that which the brothers consigned Yosef. This time, they don't even have to be guilty. They don't even have to make up a story. All they have to do is go back to Yaakov and say, we messed up. Our brother was caught with the stolen goods in his belongings. We don't think he did it. He might have been framed, but we had no choice but to leave him there. And yet, in the beginning of this week's Seder, we have Yehuda, the spokesman and leader among the brothers, who last week, in the end of Parshat Miketz, humbled himself before this viceroy of Egypt, unknown to him, his own brother Yosef, now boldly confronts him. Vayigash Elav Yehuda. He approaches him, the commentaries say, on equal footing. You might be the big man here, but I am the big man of the house of Yaakov, and I am not going to go back to Yaakov without my brother. Take me instead. And Yosef breaks down and reveals himself to his brothers, and the brothers are reconciled, put that word in quotes, because the question will always be, were they really reconciled? In Vayigash, it looks good. They hug and they kiss and they talk to each other. And Yosef repeatedly says, I don't hold it against you and don't feel guilty. This was God's plan and we were all pawns in that plan. And yet we see, especially in next week's reading of Vayichi, that the brothers were never convinced that Yosef really forgave them for what they had done, and perhaps they just felt guilty even with his forgiveness, or maybe because of it. And the end of the book of Bereshit, which is in next week's Sedra of Vayichi, ends with the family growing to large nationhood, pre-nationhood, but being mired in Egypt. The book of Shemot begins with severe oppression and slavery in Egypt, and it's not till later that we are redeemed and taken out of Egypt. So you look at the story of Yosef and his brothers, and you're hoping for, and they lived happily ever after, but it is not yet to be. Sadly enough, the clash of Yosef and his brothers manifests itself many generations later in the split of the kingdom into Judah on the one hand and Yosef or Ephraim on the other hand, the 10 tribes that break away, and things are not good, and they're still not good, and we still don't have and they lived happily ever after. Therefore, right after Hanukkah, when we celebrate the victories of the Hashmonaim and the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash and the beginning of an autonomous period that didn't last too long until we fell under the thumb of Rome, we now face on the Jewish calendar not only the fast of the 10th of Tevet, but there is tragedy recorded and associated with the 8th of Tevet and the 9th of Tevet, and our sages would never impose three fast days day after day, so instead they took the events of the 8th and the 9th, and they focused them on the 10th, and we've even added one in our own time, and the 10th of Tevet represents different, I don't know, let's call it for lack of a better term, bad things that happened to the Jewish people, and the fact that we are about to fast again on the 10th of Tevet is sad not only because of what happened once upon a time, a long time ago, but what happened not just even recently, but what continues to happen. I believe with all my heart that when we are worthy of the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, it will be rebuilt, and we will not fast on the four fast days associated with the destruction. That means that as long as we fast on these, they are not just historical notes, but they are a picture of the current situation. We continue to destroy the Beit HaMikdash with gratuitous hatred, with turning our backs on God, and the only solution that we can do something about is to return to Torah, take it, learning, practice of mitzvot, spreading this to our fellow Jews, teaching the rest of the world the values of a Torah way of life, and not expecting the rest of the world to become Jewish, but at least to continue to become moral and to recognize the God of Israel as the one true God in the world. The 8th of Tevet marks the yahrzeit of Ezra and Nehemiah. These were the people who were instrumental in bringing back people from exile, from Babylonian exile, to the land of Israel to rebuild Jewish life, a Jewish state, a Jewish commonwealth, and a Jewish Beit HaMikdash. And yet, a small fraction of the people in exile returned with them. That sort of fated the Second Temple to not be the forever after one that we are still hoping for. And their passing becomes a poignant reminder of, nice try, but we gotta try harder. We need a Beit HaMikdash, we need a Torah state and a Torah environment to flourish as an autonomous Jewish people. And our enemies from the outside, and our great-meaning friends from the outside, will have to take the backseat position, and then a grudging respect, and then an actual admiration of what we, the Jewish people, do in this land to restore things to the way they should be, and to even go beyond them. The 9th of Tevet marks the date of Targum Shivim, the forced translation of the Torah into Greek. This basically, the way that I think about it, is the insistence on the part of the rest of the world to say, God gave you the Torah, we want it also, give it to us, and forcing us to translate it, and then taking that translation and translating it into other languages and making the Bible the all-time best-selling book in the history of the world. Very nice, except for one very serious thing. The world does not have the whole Torah. The world took the written word of the Torah and said, that's all we need. Keep your Talmud, keep your oral traditions. In fact, in some periods of Jewish history, don't keep your oral traditions, but let us burn your Talmuds also, and let us stop with all of this stuff. We have the Word of God. They don't. The Bible in print is not the full Word of God. Don't have time to go into all of this more, and sorry to end on this kind of note, but let me wish you a Shabbat Shalom and a hope for the future when the fast days related to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash will turn into joyous celebrations of the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. B'mheira v'yameinu, Amen. L'hishtameah.